Morning, everybody. Can you hear me at the back? That's the important bit. Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thank you very much for the warm welcome. And thank you to Jane and the team for inviting me. And thank you, Andrew, for that wonderful introduction. I don't know what that's got to do with Che Guevara, but there we go. I promised not to reveal the name of John Wesley's horse, even if you press me with coffee and cake. Just a little bit of introduction from me, where I'm coming from. Hopefully so you can see why I, when I was offered a list of choices of which topic, I chose this one to speak about and share with you. I was born in a household that I would say was not a church household. It turned out later in life that my mum was actually a confirmed Anglican, but as a child I wasn't taken to church and it wasn't part of my life. I came to Christ in my early teens, and very much then as an outsider, coming into a world that I knew nothing about. And I think it's one of, I guess, God's blessings to me that I've continued that sense of, as I engage with church, in always trying to think about what it looks like from the outside. And that led me to learn about and be interested in, where has the church come from? Why do we do things the way we do? Where do these ideas come from? Have we always done it that way? Why do we do it in this way now? So I was kind of considering myself, that's still my perspective. I know it's impossible to remain outside because I'm part of the church and have been for many years, but I always try and think about that perspective. And likewise, I'm very interested, have the same curiosity, I suppose, about our culture. How do I come to live the way I live? Where has my culture come from? What has it been influenced by? And I guess as I was sort of coming into ministry and people were asking me about, well, what my increasingly describing it as one of reconciliation. Trying to reconcile what the church thinks it is compared with what the culture thinks it is. And likewise, trying to bring the two together to see the commonalities and the shared understandings that we have. And likewise with our culture, obviously, trying to see what culture thinks of church and trying to bridge that gap and say, well, actually, church is actually like this. This is actually what's going on here. So I would like to think of it as a ministry of reconciliation. And in doing so, I've become a collector of sayings and conversations. I'm always fascinated talking to people from all walks of life, church and non-church. And I find when you talk to people, things just stick in my mind. And so I'm a bit of a collector. So you'll find what I'm about to say peppered with remembered conversations, which I think are significant. I'm probably imbuing in them more significance than the person said it at the time, but they're often things I've gone away and thought about and thought, that conversation tells me something either about how church is seen or what's going on in our culture. So I'll start with one. I was speaking to a young man down in Brighton at what I would call a missional community down there. It was a Methodist church. Oh, by the way, I'm not... Thank you, Andrew. I've come to Methodism late in life, I should say. I'm a bit of a mongrel, really. When I first came to faith, I joined a house church. I had some time with a charismatic church, Pentecostal church. I did have some time with a very happy time with Baptist church for many years, and have finally sort of ended up finding a home in the Methodist church. So again, that kind of reflects my interest in, oh, this church is like this, but I wonder where it's come from, and finding, oh, this church is interesting, they do things this way. So a bit of that. Sorry, back to this guy down in Brighton. And fantastic missional community there, doing lots of good work with the community, such as running HIV lunches and things like that. And I was kind of surprised to find this young gentleman there. So I got chatting with him and asked him, how did he come to be involved in the church? Because he's sort of in his mid-30s, that kind of age group that many churches don't have many people. Forgive me if you're in your mid-30s and a man, but we tend to lack those. So I was very interested, how did you come to be here? why is it you're here at this Methodist church? At which he said something very profound. He said, oh, I love you Methodists, because you always have cake with everything. Which is true. It's in our statements in various places. But I pressed him a little bit more and said, but how did you... It turned out he had been asked to do some photography of the new building that had been opened. But then he said something really interesting. He said, and when I came in, I was surprised to find what a lovely building you have. It's bright, it's light, it's airy, it's comfortable, and the people are friendly and welcoming. And I was really impressed. And you were talking and I heard messages about things that I was interested in. And you shared my concerns for what's going on in our society. So I've stayed. I thought, oh, that's really interesting, you know, really affirming for the church. So then I sort of pressed him again and said, what were you expecting to find? And he said, and again, with no malice, he was just sharing his thoughts. He wasn't making any points. He just said, well, I don't know. I thought there might be, it might be dark. I was expecting candles. I thought there might be crucifixes up on the wall. You know, people in black walking about, some chanting, something like that. And I went away thinking, my goodness, when was the last time you were in a church? And I realized that, of course, he hadn't ever been in a church. And his only sort of ideas about what church communities are like was, of course, from film and television and social media. We've all seen them, haven't we? The detective stories, where, of course, a lovely atmospheric church with candles and adds a bit to the suspense. Or it tends, sadly, to be that if there's a sort of faith community, there's something suspicious about them, they're a bit weird, they're a bit cliquey, they're a bit judgmental. And, of course, the vicar or the minister is either usually totally useless and knows nothing, or is somehow something a bit sinister. But if that's your only view of church, your only engagement, it's not his fault, is it, that that's what he thinks? So I want to, that's my starter, my opener, really. How do we bridge some of those gaps with people in our culture? If that's what they think they're going to find, if they, oh, would you like to come along to Well Street? And they have this image of crucifixes and people in robes. I want to come back to the gospel passage that we had. And I'm going to add a little bit to it, if you don't mind. Because Jesus goes on to say this very important part. He says, I still have many things to say to you, but you can't bear them now. But when the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all truth. For he will not speak on his own, but will speak whatever he hears, and he will declare to you the things that will come. He will glorify me because he will take from what is mine and declare it to you. All that the Father has is mine, and for this reason, I said, he will take what is mine and declare it to you. Dear friends, as we think about mission, a missional community, there's probably a couple of words that pop in your mind that, and you're probably expecting me to talk about. The first one is gospel, and the second one is probably faith. So I am going to talk about those, but perhaps not in the way you might expect. I want to suggest that the massive shift, a paradigm shift, if I can use that phrase, the massive turnaround that Jesus brought to his listeners and ever since then that he brought into the world, the massive difference he made was in, as he says in this passage, introducing people to the idea that you can have a conversation with God. In fact, the ministry of Christ, I think the gospel of Jesus, is the invitation for people to engage in a direct dialogue with God. I would suggest that before then, thoughts about how you relate to God were more like a monologue. God says something and I go and do. Obviously, the exceptions were the patriarchs, but they were kind of held in high regard because they had had a conversation, God had spoken to them. But for most people, The way you dealt with your thoughts about faith was, well, I wait till God has said this and I go and act. The revelation in Jesus was, God wants you to come and engage in a dialogue, a one-to-one with the divine being. What an amazing thing. That is the good news of the gospel, that God is open to that dialogue and, as Jesus makes clear here, is already engaging in it with us through the Spirit. The Spirit is sent out to whisper those words of call to each of us, to come and have that conversation. Now, it's really important, I think, that we recognize that that is the good news of the gospel. That calling of God to us to engage with the divine being in conversation, in dialogue, that's really important for us to be able to talk about and to articulate to people. That's what we're about here together, isn't it? Us as a community, as individuals, responding to God's Spirit, speaking to God in the Spirit, and engaging in that conversation. Now, you'll probably say to me, oh, but what about faith? Absolutely. I preach faith. My faith is in the life, ministry, death, and resurrection of Christ. And it is through faith that we receive the redemption of God given to us by grace. However, faith has become such a catchword, if I can use that, in our churches. It's become the sole message that we give so often that it's actually, I want to say today, become problematic. Maybe not for us who feel we do know that faith in our hearts. But in terms of mission, when we talk about it with our culture, it's problematic. And I want to explain why. But the first thing I want to say is that you and I must recognize that faith comes about through our engagement with the divine conversation. I could almost say it's guaranteed that if you're going to start a conversation with God, if I can put it as lightly as that, God is going to be leading you to faith. He's going to say, trust me, and this is why you should trust me. That's where the conversation is always going to go. But it's important for us to recognize in our own faith journeys that faith is not the starting point of the conversation. The conversation begins first through Christ's Spirit calling to us, and that can be through people or through hearing the word of God or other interactions, or it can, for some people, just be being in nature and seeing wonderful things. The birth of a child can make them think suddenly about, what do I do with these feelings? Oh, they have a sense of the divine. Faith is a point we reach in that conversation, and it's one that God will always lead us to, but it's not the beginning of the conversation. And if we're going to think about mission, that's really important to know and understand. Another conversation. Young man I know, still in contact with him, got a beautiful soul. He is caring about the environment, he's caring about those around him. He's the kind of young man who, if he sees someone in trouble, will be the first one to go and see if he can help. And in talking to him, I was so interested in his attitude to life and his awareness of his own spirituality and his thoughts about that. And I mentioned to him, have you ever thought about getting involved in a church community? Because I was kind of thinking you'd fit right in, you'd find a home there. And again, he said to me without any malice, he said, well, I couldn't. And I said, well, why not? Well, I don't have faith. People go to church because they have faith. I don't have faith. I'd be a hypocrite if I went. I couldn't do it to them. Because they'd be, if I joined in the singing, they'd think I believe what I was singing and I don't, so I don't go. I have to say, I admire his integrity and his honesty, his authenticity. At this point, I have to make a confession to you. And I've already had one conversation, which I know means you won't like to hear this, so please be gentle with me. I don't like football. I'm sorry, but I don't like football. Growing up, I just never got the bug, and I just don't. But as I was thinking about what this young man said, I realised, yeah, actually, I know exactly what you're saying. I don't like football. It would be hypocritical of me to go and stand in a football match and cheer for a team and have conversations with people. Say, oh, yeah, what a great goal. Oh, that was great, wasn't it? Really good play. It would be wrong. I just wouldn't do it. It wouldn't be me. And likewise, taking it a little bit further into our experience of sort of sharing the gospel and things like that and how we do that, even if my friends were saying to me, oh, you really should come along, it's great, we have a great time, it's not as bad as you think, I still wouldn't go because I don't like football. Even, I dare say, she's not here today, bless her, but if my wife was a football fan, I can imagine the conversation on a Saturday morning would be, oh, bye, see ya. I think you should come. No, I'm not coming. So we can relate to that young man, can't we? That if church is just a place of faith, and you don't have faith, then you don't go. I think our church has in some ways overemphasized that aspect of what it is to be a disciple of Christ to the point where it's become problematic. Now, please hear me. I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about faith and we shouldn't say that we share our faith. I'm not saying that. But I think we need to be sensible and we need to be aware of what it looks like from the outside. And that's the point I'm making. I think the church has missed that sort of opportunity for changing its message as our culture changed over the last 100 or so years. And it's left the two sides kind of at odds with each other. I want to tell another couple of stories. You see, if we're involved in the divine conversation, the word that I want to use for that is spiritual. We're involved in a spiritual journey. And rather than being known as people of faith, I want to suggest that what we should be known as are spiritual experts. Spiritual people. People who understand what it is and how we are to live spiritually. Take attention to our spiritual nature in our culture. Now, if my young friend had heard that about church, I think he'd be in. I don't think we see ourselves as spiritual experts, and there are many, I will spare you lots of reasons for this, but I want two examples of proof, if you like, that I think we have failed somehow to develop that aspect of our relationship with God. I'm very interested and a practitioner of mindfulness, when I remember, but I was so interested that I decided to run a couple of courses at my church looking at a sort of Christian mindfulness, so a link to that. And I had quite a good response. Most of the people who came were already members of the church community. But what was really fascinating was when we all joined together, each group I had, I started the session by saying, why are you here? Why have you come? What is it that interests you about what we're going to do? And no word of a lie, 99% of them said exactly this, and please hear the emphasis. Well, although I've been coming to church for many years, I'm actually really interested in spirituality. Another one was, well, I am a Christian, but I don't know much about prayer or my faith, but I'm really interested in spirituality. It was always separate. I'm a Christian, but I am also interested in spirituality. And I found myself wondering, how do we get to this point where we don't see ourselves as being involved in a spiritual dialogue and we don't know how to talk about that with people? That we see faith as being something unspiritual? My Bible tells me that faith is a gift of God. It's a gift of the Spirit. It's developed in us and worked in us through the Spirit. And yet we don't think of ourselves as spiritual people. Lockdown was a very difficult time for all of us, I know. I, at the time, was ministering with three churches. And I must confess, I got very disappointed and then very angry. Within 2 or 3 weeks of being in lockdown and the churches being closed, people on the telephone started to tell me that they were lost. I don't know what to pray. I don't know how to worship. I can't worship. And I found myself thinking, and these were people who had sat on the pews for some of them 50 years or more, week on week. And yet, what made me angry was, what have we failed to do such that when there's not someone at the front saying prayers for them, they don't know what to say? Where is that divine dialogue within their spirit? How have we not cultivated that? How have we not taught and encouraged these people in their discipleship where that, wherever they are, whatever their circumstance, they know how to pray? And why is that a problem? Well, the problem, really, we might say, we recognise, is probably in falling numbers for the church. But it's also a problem, I want to say, because there's been this shift in our culture. It's a fascinating thing to learn about, but I was saying to Jane earlier, there's so much that I'm actually using notes today. I don't usually need, but I have to use notes, otherwise I'll go on for hours. I know Andy said that was all right last night, but it's probably not. There has been a massive, equally, I think, to sort of almost to Christ's shift in the way we think about ourselves and the way we understand our culture, the way we relate to one another in culture. I keep using that word, don't I? So I'm going to define it a little bit. What is culture? It's the air that we breathe. It's the water we all swim in. But importantly, it's the way we signify meaning to one another. It's the way we show something as being significant. It's the way we talk about ourselves without talking about ourselves. It's the way we share, and it's full, it's a multi sort of faceted conversation. We contribute to culture in our lives, but we also receive from it. And likewise, we contribute to others, and it's to and fro all the time. It's not a one-way street. It's the arts that we like and don't like. It's the clothes we wear, the places we go, the shops, the things we buy, the cars we drive, all those things. They're all a way of our culture showing what's important to us as a society. What do we rate? What do we value? What do we tolerate? What do we not? But most essentially, the big difference has been in for the individual. How does an individual show to society that they are a worthy member, that they're acceptable? What is a good person? And that shift has been massive. If you go back 100 years or so, it was very simple. The way you showed that you were a good member of society could be put on a simple list. You dressed well. You kept your hair a certain style. You went to church on Sunday. You were married. You had a job. And you were sort of, you know, you were a good person. As you probably kept your job and you didn't make any trouble, basically. That's how you showed, signified in culture that you were a good citizen. That's what people were looking for. The massive shift is that has now gone. The way you show that you are a good citizen is about you as a person, as an individual, being authentic, being yourself. It's about whether you are true to yourself and whether you are honestly you. That's been the massive shift. So it's not about what people see you doing. It's about what's going on inside of you. That's what authenticity and a good citizen looks like. So my friend is being a good citizen when he says, well, I'm not being a hypocrite. Whereas there are many people, I suspect, who are older generations who still, I had a lady in one of my churches, I remember her saying to me, we were talking about Christian witness, And she said, my witness is people see me going to church on a Sunday morning. Totally external. It's not what I feel. Didn't ask what she thought was going on inside her when she went to church, but that's her witness. That's a good example of the difference. Now, I've pointed out that sort of a negative thing. There are negatives about that shift in culture, which I'll say a little bit more about in a moment. I hope as you hear what I'm about to say, that perhaps the promise of the gospel that you and I have experienced, perhaps, you might just start to have a sense of hope or perhaps even excitement rising within you as we think what it's like to be an individual in our culture today. We live in a world now where citizens in the West are in a closed universe. They're in a closed cosmos. Each individual kind of is in a buffer zone. A buffer zone. If we go back to the time of the Reformation, for example, an open cosmos, that's where everyone lived. As in God, the devil, demons, spirits, sprites, fairies. An individual is open to all these things. All these things can affect me and impact my life. They might come and make me ill. They might come and make me fall over. They might do all kind of horrible things to me. I'm open to all the elements, supernatural, everything. That's how people were. Today, I've got a magic shield around me. We don't believe in the supernatural. There's nothing outside of me and what I see and feel and hear that can affect me. Even culture is filtered by me, not by someone else. I choose what I look at, where I go. Is this sounding familiar? I hope so. Because, dear friends, the other thing we have to realize is that we are part of culture. We are not separate from it. We cannot separate ourselves from it. We are brought up in it. We use it all every day. It is literally the air we breathe. So there is no us and them when it comes to mission. We are part of the same culture as everybody else. We may have slightly different meanings on things. We may interpret things slightly differently, but we're in the same culture. But this buffered zone is not a peaceful place. The individual is now the only one to judge the goodness or the rightness of things. There's no external source that people trust. And we see that in our media and stuff, don't we? Only I can decide what to do, what's best for me. So I'm anxious about that. How do I know if I've got it right? How do I know if I'm authentic to myself? Who am I really? How do I find significance? What if I'm just one in a billion, billion people in the middle of a vast cosmos that doesn't care about me? How do I find purpose? How do I find that sense of joy in being alive? If there's only me, how can I trust anything? And perhaps most importantly, what do I do when I get it wrong? When I make mistakes? When I let myself down? What do I think about myself when I don't do the things I know I want to do and could do? How do I get help for that? Can we hear a whisper of a gospel there somewhere? But that's what we are like. That's our culture and how it works. However, in everything that I've read and in the conversations that I've had, I want to assure you that God is at work in our world. And despite us living in a buffered zone, there is still that rumour, and it is just a rumour, that God might still be there. That there might be something in the spiritual life. That there might be, there's an echo, if you like, that there's something there that might be helpful. They haven't quite dismissed it, but they don't quite know what to make of it and where to find it. A missional community must make that door open and easy. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. But what we have to recognise, I guess, is that we're now at the point where there are generations of people who, like my friend at the beginning, just have no knowledge of church. It's for them a completely unknown thing. So even if they have these thoughts of where can I find significance, they don't think to look to the church, partly because they think that's to do with faith, but partly because they just don't really know what we're about. I suggest because for many years we have not really articulated that amongst ourselves either. The story of a lady I know who noticed that lots of people were wearing crucifixes or wearing crosses as part of their fashion, or some of them because they were people of faith. And she went into the shop and said, oh, I'd like to buy a cross, please. And he showed her various ones. And she said, oh, no, I want one with a little man on it. Have you got one with a little man on it? People just are not familiar with the things that you and I might take for granted. We need to bear that in mind. Why do we need to bear it in mind? Because in the hope that people will come into contact with us, if we're sharing with them the gospel of a conversation with God, if we're sharing with them how we know about how to pray, how we meditate, how we contemplate, how we understand the importance, how we come to reading the Bible, how we interpret it, how we perhaps don't just take it literally, but how we study it and talk about it, such that we are a little bit more on the expert level of spirituality. The other key thing is that when people come amongst us, they must feel comfortable. They must feel that they recognise some things from their culture. They must feel that some of the things we talk about and the concerns and the issues that we pray for and discuss together, they must be the same things that they are interested in. Which is not difficult, because it's all about being a human being, isn't it? It's about failure. And what do I do? Where do I find hope? How do I think of this? What's going on in our world today? How do I deal with it? What's my response? What's a spiritual response to that? It's not difficult, but I think it has to be part of our mindset if we're going to be missional, that when people come in, they recognise themselves here in some way. So with the greatest respect, it might be fascinating to have, you know, if I could have preached on Nehemiah or someone and talked about, you know, the rise and fall of Babylon and all those sorts of things, fascinating Bible study, but what does it mean for the individual in that buffered world? How does it help them be less anxious? Where does it give them hope? Where's the redemption for that person in that message? I'm going to be really foolish now. I've been foolish many times in my life, but this is probably one of the worst ones. I'm going to dare to try and summarise the epistles, the letters that we have in the New Testament, just as a way of rounding up for us. What might we learn from them about being a missional community that could emphasise those things that we've talked about for those individuals as we encounter them in our culture? What should we be like? And I think we have to look at the early church. I say church. Paul wasn't writing to a church. He was writing to a group of varied people who normally wouldn't be seen dead in a room together, basically. He was calling them church, but it was an optimistic name. All walks of life, all different parts of culture, who were brought together by that call of the Spirit because they'd answered that and they were wanting to engage in the divine conversation. So, what are the three things that you'll find emphasised in the letters? Number one, the centrality of the person of Christ. Jesus is the centre of the church's life and work. Jesus is the centre of their worship, the centre of their liturgy, the centre of all their theology, etc. And that must be the same for us. That must remain the same for us. One of the shifts that's happened in culture that came through the Enlightenment is that when philosophers, if I can put it that way, and even theologians talked about the state of humankind and started to try and respond to the ideas about science and about evolution versus creation, there was a subtle shift in the theology. They started to talk about God, but they talked about God alone, what we call theism. And they forgot about the Trinity. The Trinity wasn't included in discussions about creation. It's not, if you listen to some of the, you know, philosophical debates and people talk, oh, what about God? Well, God could do this and God could do this. They're not talking about Jesus. They're talking about God alone, God all-knowing, all-powerful. And because of that, the church lost the arguments because they dropped the Trinity. My dear friends, without the person of Christ, we don't have an answer for suffering. Without the person of Christ, we don't have a response to those people in distress when they see terrible things happening in the world. Without the person of Christ, we don't have an answer when they say, why do babies die? Where is God in this or that situation? Without the Trinity, we don't have an answer. Because if you're just talking about one God, all-powerful, I agree with them. Yes, I don't know why God wouldn't do that. But they're forgetting about Christ. So we must be a Christ-centered community if we're going to be missional. I have a good friend who's a Buddhist. She's a wonderful woman, deeply spiritual, so kind, so loving. And she's very, very devout in following her faith. She goes to all kinds of retreats. She's trained to be the equivalent of a minister, I suppose. But we were having a conversation in the kitchen one day, and it was one of those parting comments just before she left. And I'd been sharing something of my spiritual journey. And she looked at me and she said, ah, Stuart, you know, sometimes I do wish God had a personal face. I sometimes wish I had a God like yours who I could call Father. The centrality of Jesus Christ in our community must not be lost. It's the thing that gives us relevance. It gives us something to say to people when they are suffering and in difficulty. So I might say, our culture might say to us, as I've seen, as I'm sure you have, or put up on buses, God is dead. So I might say, our culture says God is dead, but Jesus Christ is alive and kicking. We must hold to that. Secondly, the writers of the epistles insisted on orthodoxy. They insisted on orthodoxy. And by that I mean, they were very clear to all those groups of people, you have come from somewhere. You are not the latest thing to appear in God's mind. This is where you've come from. And they, like Paul, quite clearly pointed out all the way back to Genesis. This is part of God's plan. You are part of God's story. You are not the new thing on the block. You have grown out of this tree. This is where you've come from. And don't forget it. It's really important for us as a missional community to make sure that we are aware ourselves and we communicate this to others that we are part of that 2,000 plus heritage of Christian living and experience. That is so important because we have all those riches of all those spiritual conversations that all the different denominations and all the different iterations of church have had over the years to draw from. And we should know about them and we should be making use of them so that when people come amongst us, if they have a problem, we know where to point them. We can say, well, have you tried this? What about, have you read so-and-so? This, oh, well, what you're experiencing, this is like Saint Ignatius, or I've got this story to tell you. If we live in a culture where people are desperate for significance, I can think of nothing more significant than being part of a movement that's over 2,000 years old. There's a stability in that. I'm afraid if we try and say that Well Street, thank goodness, we've arrived, we've finally got the gospel right. You can forget about the rest of church and all the Christian, we've got it right, just stick with us. That won't wash. What people are seeking is that deep sense of commitment to something bigger than themselves that I believe only the Christian church can offer because we've got 2,200 years of it. But you and I must know about it as well. We must have access to it. A friend of mine was talking to my wife, and she doesn't go to church, and she was talking about, various things, and then she mentioned that she had a life coach. So my wife said, oh, that's interesting. What's that? How does that work? See if you recognize this. She said, well, what we do is we meet as a group once a week, and we have a few words of welcome from the convener, and then we share together things that have gone well during the week, and we sort of spend a moment being, grateful for that. And then we start to share things that haven't gone so well, and we'll often have a time of silence as we reflect on those things. And then we take advice from one another, and we round it off usually with the convener. We'll say some words about what we might do going forward and what might be helpful. And as soon as my wife had finished relating this, I said to her, but that's the Exorcism prayer, isn't it? Have you heard of that? 1,000 years old. It's the Exorcism prayer that many people use every day. The only difference is, instead of a life coach, the conversation is with God. You sit with God and give thanks for the things that have gone well, the things you've noticed, the places you've noticed God's face in the day. And then you confess to God the things that haven't gone so well. You take a moment of silence and ask God to show. It's the Exorcism, but it's now called a life coach. We should be able to point people to these things. They are in need of them. They're finding them through life coaches, but really they need to find the Exorcism prayer. But we need to know that that's there in our history, in our tradition, that we can offer it to them. Lastly, we have to live it. We have to live it. Our lives have to reflect those two aspects, the centrality of Christ and that connection to our tradition. And just to repeat, I think what Paul was really getting at was that people need to recognize that the divine conversation is actually happening here. If we live and behave as though that's not important and we don't take any notice of it, then people will go away and say, well, you say you're in conversation with God, but I don't see it in your lives. We must live it in conversation. That doesn't mean perfection. That means sharing our difficulties, sharing our brokenness, being prepared to confess that we don't get it right all the time. But it must be part of that divine conversation. Well, in conclusion, I think if you're even considering being a missional community, you're very brave people. You are very brave people. You're going to need to be brave as you go forward. Because if we accept what I'm saying, that we're being called into a conversation with God, it's going to take us to new places. It's going to take us to new people and new conversations. It's going to bring us to new ways of being church. It must do, mustn't it? Because that divine conversation brings us to eternal life. New life. And as anyone who's ever had a baby or a grandchild in the family, new life is disruptive. It upsets things. It means you can't carry on as you were before because you've got this new thing amongst you which has needs and makes demands upon you. So I'm afraid to say, if you want your church to stay the same, then please do ignore everything I've said this morning. If your concern for mission, and I'm not saying this is you, but I have heard this kind of articulated, I won't say where, but if your main concern of mission is because you're worried you haven't got enough people to serve coffee and you need more people to go on the steward's rota, and what are we going to do if we haven't got enough people to do this? If that's your concern for mission, forget it. New life. New life is what we're about, that divine conversation with God. But that, of course, is exactly the place to be. What an exciting place where new life is breaking out amongst us and those we meet and those we draw in as we experience that divine conversation. And as we share that joyous moment when, as we heard in Christ's words, people hear their names, your name spoken at the throne of grace, and you know God is talking to you and means you. What an exciting place to be. May God bless you in your endeavours to be a missional community. Amen.